BBC Sounds.
Davey Scott back with another bonus episode of Classic Scottish Albums from BBC Radio Scotland. And this week you're going to get an even closer look at how we go about making the programmes. The key interview for this week's episode on Wet Wet Wet's Popped and Sold Out was a logistical challenge. I'm not going to say nightmare, challenge for producer Elizabeth Clark. Tommy was with me in the studio in Glasgow. Fine, no problem there. And Tommy, as you'll hear, can talk. But we then had to take in Neil on a Skype connection from a garden in rural Norfolk. Yes, folks, you heard that right. And Graham on FaceTime from a kitchen somewhere in the Shires. So you might hear lines dropping on and off here and there, kettles boiling, birds chirping, blah, blah, blah. Expect the unexpected. It was chaos, but it was creative, wonderful chaos. There's more than one story with this record, so really interested in how you guys actually got got the thing finished and got it out there. So we'll talk about this around. We'll go around the house just with it a wee bit. In the oops,
who have we lost?
Okay, let's plough on and get what we can get, folks. Let's start. I mean, just talk about the genesis of the band, really. I mean, Tommy, maybe give us a kind of brief sort of summary of how you got together as a group.
Wet 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 are a classic school band. We are the kids who at lunchtime and break time got together and listened to what was ever in the charts and discussed music. Punk had happened, new wave was happening, there was a resurgence in the kind of soul thing, and there we were. Just coming to the end of our school years, we only had one focus. There really was music just filled, you know, every pore of our body, and that's what drew us together. We didn't like all the same music. In fact, we still argue about our love of music to this day, because we're all individuals and listen to different stuff. But that kind of started me in my knowledge. Graham was introducing me to his likes and dislikes in music. Neil was bringing in his influences, and you add that into the melting pot and it makes you grow. You grow as a person, you grow as a musician. And so it was very easy for us to just say to each other, right, well, why don't we rehearse? Started off just Graham and I, you know, very cheap instruments. Parents would go out and we would just take over the room, you know, the houses for a couple hours and start learning how to play the instruments. Neil came in doing keyboards. We knew we needed a singer. We remembered Mark, now known as Marty, from school as having a great voice. And so there we were, just leaving school and just starting to kind of gravitate towards each other, you know, just getting pulled towards each other.
You know, I think it's really interesting that what you say, that you weren't all listening to the same music, and I totally get that. Mm. But I think most people listening to early Wet 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 music, yeah, the Popped and Sold Out and the Memphis Sessions and all that, hear a band that are super, super focused on soul music. And yeah. How is it that you all coalesced around that?
Graham? Well, that, you know, I think that would have been down to a couple of factors, and the one main factor was, you know, although, as Tommy rightly said, we were listening to a lot of kind of alternative, what would be termed alternative and indie nowadays, you know, I mean, we just didn't have these terms back then. You know, I think I wanted to be that type of band, man, you know what I mean? Like a Smiths or like a Magazine or like a Clash or something like that, you know, sort of rock-driven indie music. And, you know, one of the main factors was that there was a guy singing the songs that wasn't Howard Devoto, you know, he wasn't a drummer, man. And, yep, you know, that kind of, you know, I don't think it was an intentional thing for us to say, right, okay, let's, you know, that's not going to work for us, so let's be a soul band. We were making it up as we went along, man, do you know what I mean? We were kind of, we wanted to desperately to play music, we wanted desperately to write a song that would somehow endure, and I know that now. I didn't necessarily know that at the time, but, you know, you're sort of poking around in a dark room, man, you know, for want of a better phrase.
And there is that kind of slight tradition of early 80s groups starting off as kind of scratchy, indie approach. I'm thinking Spandau Ballet, Skritti Politti, and then turn it into this soulful.
Even Della Mitri, to an extent.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at their first album, it bears no resemblance to what was to come later on, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I was going to go on and say there that another factor about us being the sort of band we are, I think we all kind of progressed at the same sort of level. You know, it wasn't like one of us suddenly became an impresario or a fantastic, brilliant musician. You know, I think we all were pretty much learning our instrument, as Tommy said, you know, and then after a couple of years, you become proficient, and then after a few more years, you know, you become pretty good. Now, none of us kind of raced ahead of any of the people in the band, you know, so that kind of kept it sort of, you know, we were all at the same kind of level.
Yeah.
So that was another factor that, you know, led us down this kind of sort of soul road. But, you know, I think if you take kind of the voice out of the equation, you know, there was kind of soul tinges in there, like, you know, songs like East of the River. But, you know, if you look at us, not unlike Della Mitri's first album, you know, when we moved on in the later albums, it did take its own different flavour. You know, there was still the kind of soul nod of the hat, you know, nod of the head to that kind of genre. But I think we moved on and we'd cultivated our own sound, you know.
Tommy.
Yeah, so soul music is probably the meeting point. That's probably what you do when you take all these different genres of music that we were listening to and forcing upon each other. There was middle ground, and the middle ground, especially again with Marty's voice, really was soul-based. And we found...
And I mean, sorry, Tom, but I mean, the other thing was, you know, we met Elliot Davis at that point, and it was him that really said, oh man, you know, you've got this kind of soul singer, and, you know, he looks like a guy in The Clash, you know what I mean? So there was this sort of juxtaposition there, you know, and it was him that really kind of rammed that home to us. You know, he had a massive record collection, and guys like Al Green, who we all knew of, but we didn't necessarily, you know, go and listen to him. So, yeah, I suppose that was the path that we then kind of walked upon, you know, together.
Okay, so I tell you what, right, I think we've covered tons. That's really, really good. Neil, are you still with us?
I'm still with you. Yeah.
Good. So maybe I'll throw the next question over to you, and we're talking really more specifically about Popped In, Sold Out. And one of the things that both, I think, Tommy and Graham said there, or at least suggested, was this collaborative, you know, making music and growing together. And actually, when you look at the credits for Popped In, Sold Out, you've got four-way writing credits on there, and I'm interested in how that process worked as a band. I've never written anything with any you know, any more than two people. I cannot imagine, you know, that sort of four-way process. It sounds amazingly challenging and exciting. So, Neil, how did it work for you? He didn't like it. Neil, are you still there?
No, we've lost.
Right, okay. So while we get Neil back, Tommy, why don't you pick up on that one, then we'll move over to Graham.
Yeah, even though there's four names credited on the album, there is a writing force within Wet, 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 and it really is Graham and Neil. My memory for Popped In, Sold Out is the record company signed us believing us to have hundreds of songs. We lied through our teeth. We've got hundreds. They're all brilliant. We'd only done about three demos or something. So they put us into Amazon Studios down in Liverpool, and we went, right, we've got to come up with a backbone of a whole album here. We've got to try and get a repertoire together, all these little ideas and little pieces. And Neil and Graham would sit 2 hours before we were going to record a song and make it up. I remember East of the River coming together, Neil getting the piano part and Graham going, right, great, that's the intro, that's the verse, we need a bridge. And it would just be piano driven. All it would be keyboards, and then they would say, right, we think we've got a structure. No melody, no vocal melody, no choruses. We don't know where everything's going yet. Let's play it. And the band in the studio would simply say, right, let's hear the chords. Let's learn it quickly. I'm talking about two run-throughs and say, right, let's put that down. And that's how our songs came together. Temptation came along like that. Wishing I Was Lucky was put together in pieces. And East of the River, honestly, my memory is an hour before being shown these chords and going, right. And what we've done is, because of our background, because we came up, as Equal said, as equal members of the band, pushing forward and learning and using all the skills that everyone brings to the table, not just songwriting, but the promotion and the, you know, the look and the sound and kind of, so we were a gang. And what we decided right back from just as we left school was, this is Equal. No one is coming to work in a Ferrari and someone's cycling. It's all Equal, or else it doesn't work. And that's why we're here 30 years later.
Yeah.
The songwriting source is definitely comes from Graham's drive and direction and Neil's musical melodic background.
Yeah. Graham.
And to add to that, I mean, you know, I'd come up through, you know, when I was, 12, it was 1977, then that whole kind of explosion. I had an older brother who was about 16 in 1977, and he had a pretty good, pretty substantial record collection. So, you know, I was mining in there, you know what I mean, listening to all this and absorbing all this kind of energetic, punky stuff that said to me, hey, look, you know, if you want to express yourself, you can. You don't need to be a fantastic musician. So that really spoke to me. Now, on those records, I always remember there was, you know, the Sex Pistols' first album. They're credited as four writers. Do you know what I mean? It's not like, you know, they're in brackets underneath Anarchy in the UK. You know, I can't remember the, you know, it'll be in alphabetical order, but it was Rotten, Vicious, you know, sometimes Rotten, Matlock, Cook and Jones, yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I really dug that kind of solidarity and thought, you know, that's how bands work. You know, we weren't, it wasn't like, you know, say Marty had came and said, hey, look, guys, I've got these songs, man, you know, a la maybe like a Deacon Blue, you know. I think Deacon Blue's sort of strung around Ricky in a sense, you know. Ricky's the kind of main songwriter, you know, that'll kind of come up with the thing, and then they string a band around him, you know. Whereas I think the difference between us and somebody like Deacon Blue is that we are an actual band and everybody has a contribution to make. And that's the beauty of it, you know. We all have pretty specific jobs here. And, you know, that as Tam said, that's how it's kind of, that's how it worked for the first 10 years. We tried kind of augmenting it, maybe tried changing it, and it never really worked. In fact, it probably worked against us doing that sort of stuff.
So you've got the because the core is the thing where that music happens. I'd like to, we're going to kind of get back on some of the specific songs on Popped and Sold Out. But before we do, just kind of check, is Neil, are you back with us?
I'm here, yeah.
Okay, Neil, that's great. Can you hear me? So let's chuck this quick question over to you, because Tommy started to talk about Amazon Studios in London, and one of the kind of, I suppose, one of the legends around about Popped and Sold Out is the amount of times you recorded it, right? And that's not an unusual experience for musicians in the 1980s, but this was something that was like to quite an extreme, wasn't it? So what was the recording kind of journey from your demos through to actually getting this record together, Neil?
Yeah, I think, well, we recorded pretty good demos, and I think the problem that we had was they were pretty hard to match when we began with, like, various producers, you know. So, I mean, you can imagine the record company was telling you to go and work with these guys, and we were going, well, we don't really rate this guy, but we kind of had to, because they told us to, you know. And And then I think we also tried to do Wishing I Was Lucky with Stephen Haigh, who's got a better track record, I think, with the Pet Shop Boys, and he's done a lot of stuff. But then again, he couldn't. We tried to reproduce the demo that Wishing I Was Lucky that we did with Wolf Smarties through in Edinburgh, and we just couldn't do it. And we had to try and persuade the record company that this song didn't really need that much. Let's put out a demo and maybe kind of tart it up a bit. So eventually, they came around the area we were thinking, because all the things hadn't worked that they'd suggested. I mean, obviously, we went into work with Willie Mitchell as well, and that was a whole kind of different thing altogether. That didn't really happen for different reasons. But I mean, I think we got signed in 85, and our first single came out in 87, which was Wishing I Was Lucky, which is pretty much the demo with a few bits and pieces added.
Yeah, we
so it was a bit of a mad kind of journey, and it was quite harrowing at the time, but we kind of came out the other end okay, I think, luckily.
With a great conversation with Wilf around about Wishing I Was Lucky. Yeah. So it would be good to spend a wee bit of time talking about that. Tommy, you've got something to...
Yeah, I've just got these memories again of Porta Studios had been invented, which was a little four-track recording onto a cassette, you know, a terrible quality, but we were trying to learn how to record. We had learned our instruments to the extent where we could count to four and get from A to B, 3.5 minutes, we could play it. And we were quite impressive when it came to the kind of live side of things, but recording was a new entity. There was no handbook, there was not even a documentary about how to go about it, there was no YouTube to show you how to mic things up. So we had the Porta Studio, and we'd work on these demos, and we'd try and get these little songs. But the real eye-opener came when we went through to Edinburgh, and we met the wild man, Wilf Smarty. Right, so we turned up at this little studio, and Wilf was, he kind of listened to everything we'd done, and went, all right, that one. And if you get anything new, and Neil was like, well, I've got these chords, you know, for Wishing. And again, Graham and Neil sat there and put these chords together. Wilf knew the technology. He was excited by the world of production. So what Wilf done is kind of went, right, dump that bit, take that bit, put that together. Let's get a little solid thing. Right, everybody ready? Play it. And Wishing I Was Lucky lit up the room. It really was a moment. It just went from this kind of really basic chord structure. Again, no vocal. We don't know what the chorus is. We don't know what the verse is going to be. It just had a drive to it. We sometimes look back and listen to Wishing I Was Lucky and say it's the kitchen sink mix, because we were that naive and that scared of missing something that we put everything into it. You know, there's 1,000 backing vocals on it. There's mad rhythms coming from every direction. There is no real... You can't really say that's influenced purely by that. It doesn't really even belong to a genre, I don't think. Wishing I Was Lucky is pure youth, energy, naivety.
Neil?
I think as well there's something that the demo had that is hard to replace. I mean, probably in any song that you record, there's an energy on it. And then sometimes you only get that like the first few times, and then you kind of repeat that again for whatever reason. You know, so Wishing I Was Lucky has that.
One of the things, though, Neil, I think is interesting, and Will talked about this.
Try to do it again.
Oh, okay.
Hold on.
Hold on, Graham. Hold on.
The other thing I'd like to add to that is, you know, in the mid 80s, you know, as Tam said, you know, the real eye opener, the penny dropping, we going into a 24 track recording studio, was, you know, all these records were being made by Tears for Fears, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, you know, they became kind of big productions, you know, and I think Wishing is testimony to, you know, you would sit with your guitar and your piano and you would write the song, you would put the structure down, whereas when you went into the studio in those days, you were sort of not so much as writing songs, but writing records, you know, and I think Wishing I Was Lucky is very much writing with all the studio techniques there. Do you know what I mean? Because you can't really break that down and sort of sit in the guitar or sit in the piano and play it from start to finish.
Yeah,
and as Neil said, you sort of created the energy inside the writing of the recording.
Yeah,
you know. So
and Graham,
it was
isn't
a different
isn't
thing. You know, we were listening. We'd been introduced to Trevor Horn. We'd sort of started listening to ABC. We were big on them. We loved the production of that. And that was our attempt at trying to do something like that, you know?
And one of the things, I think, interestingly, that Wilf talked about was how late the vocal arrived.
Yes.
For Wishing I Was Lucky. And it's a great story. I'd like to... Neil, you're laughing, so let's hear your take on that, right? Because
I can't remember, to be honest. Did it really?
You don't. You anyway, if you remember, Neil Marty sang the vocal live in the room, handheld mic, and made it up on right. the spot. Kind of idea, Graham. Perhaps you can take it, Graham.
It's what you would call, you know, people do this now, and as a therapy, but it's a stream of consciousness, man, you know, where, you know, you just give somebody a way into a bunch of chords, and then Marty would, you know, that was the amazing thing that Marty brought to the party. He would basically be given a kind of beginning, here's how it starts, and then he could go on for about 2.5 minutes and not stop and just constantly sing melodic structures over the chords. Now, in that process, it would then be suggesting things to me. Oh, that's the lyric. I'll write that down. I'll catch that. And it was a matter of, you know, you have to be quick here because it's only going to happen once or twice and then it's gone. You know, and it's that whole thing of capturing the moment. But yeah, it was done in front of the speakers with an SM58, you know what I mean? As it's coming out full blast and Marty's just given this stream of consciousness that's just pouring out his, you know, every sinew in his body.
Well, I want to ask you about that because I think it's funny. I think it can be, you can get into a wee bit of sort of a pocket Freud here, right?
Yeah.
But actually, even if you think about the lyric of that song, you know, set the world make believe, my best friend wrote and told me that there may be a job in the city. And that sense of leaving where you are and going seems to me almost to be the kind of story of Wet, Wet, Wet.
Can I say the wheels were starting to turn? We had start getting interest from record companies. We had went from bedrooms to starting to play the colleges and universities in Glasgow. So the gigs were getting bigger. Not thousands of people, but there was maybe a handful. There was maybe 40, 50 people were starting to follow us round at each show that we were doing. And so there was a and we were dole kids, we were unemployed, so there was a certain feeling that things were growing. So as soon as Marty came out with that, wishing I was lucky, all of us went, that's us, that's telling the story of Wet, Wet, Wet right now. So there's a genuine, unique moment captured in that song.
And then
Graham,
you know, out of all the songs, we meant it, and it means something. You know, that's why it resonates.
It's got that energy. Listen, don't worry about this, guys. See if you're a wee bit kind of coming over each other. We're going to be cutting this up anyway. This is actually totally brilliant, right?
Yeah.
We very rarely have the chance to get everything together at the same time. So this is really beautiful. Thank you so much.
No problem.
I think we've got a lot on Wishing I Was Lucky, and I think the song, as you kind of say, Tommy, it speaks for itself.
I just want to add just one last thing.
Okay.
Which was, so we came out from Wilf's with this demo that caught the message, the kind of, it reflected the exact soul, the exact people that we were. It still took us another 2 years before that record was able to get put out. And that's another complete story.
Yeah. So what? Yeah. And we'll. I think we got some of that from Wilf, but we'll maybe come back to that. But I want to make sure we get stuff on some of the other songs. Yep. Another one, I think, which was a Wilf's Planet song, is Angel Eyes, Home and Away. Is that right?
Yeah.
So that's
got another kind of genesis.
That's a great song, Graham. And sorry to cut across you, but just I think I was, you know, again listening to the album again last night at home, and the melody of that and the sort of the poise of the arrangement, it's so beautiful, so graceful, and I don't know, it just has a bit of gravitas about it or something. So I'll stop chucking flowers at you. You tell me about the song.
Okay, well, I mean, it started. I remember recording it in the bedroom. With the Porter Studio, and we had something that was kind of almost like a ballad, just a little bit faster. It sounded like Paul McCartney to me. You know, Marty had done some vocals, and it was like, man, that sounds McCartney-esque. We knew we had something sort of good there, the essence of a good song. We then went into Wilf, who speeded it up and made it into this kind of, I don't know, it just sounded... It sounded fresh and new. There was all the production stuff going on from the, you know, Wilf's kind of input into it. It wasn't until we went back to record the album with Michael Baker and Axel Kroll that it really kind of gelled into it. We'd done a lot of versions of it. We did a version in Wilf's Planet. We did another version in Amazon. And we were forever going back and trying to rework it. And you've got to remember, at this point, I can remember being really dismayed and disillusioned with the song because we couldn't get it right. We couldn't kind of nail it into a form that I thought was good. And it wasn't until we got to Axel and the Michael production that everything fell into place. It was taken back to be a ballad. It was then pushed in the direction of like a Lionel Richie type, Commodores type soul kind of thing. And then suddenly, you know, you put the chorus on it, which was just a line that we had from the Amazon version of the song. We stuck that in the chorus, lengthened the chorus, and suddenly it's like, you know, everyone could see it. And it was like, yeah, this will be the big kind of hit ballad after Wishing I Was Lucky and Sweet Little Mystery. You know, that was, you know, that was a kind of, you know, there was long-term planning going on here, you know, without us even kind of knowing it. You know, there was long-term planning for Popped In, Sold Out and how it was going to be stretched out and how we could sell a couple of million copies of it.
And you've also got that sort of weight that comes from a string arrangement.
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of level of ambition in the music.
There was, this is probably something Neil could probably elaborate on, but there was string machines, you know, synthesizers had come along. Neil classes himself, I know, as a Hammond and a piano player, but we had a lot of toys in the room as well, you know, the kind of emulator. So, Neil, why don't you talk about the kind of introduction of strings and synths?
Thanks, Tommy. Yeah, obviously back then, if you think I'm a great player now, man, you ought to see me back then, back in 85 and that, you know. So luckily, we had Axel and that, who would sort of come in and put all the fancy stuff in and use... He would normally just rough up strings and get real players in to play them, you know, after the fact, you know, just before we were finished the records, you know. So there was a lot of technology in that going on, as we touched on Trevor Horn, and there was emulators and all that kind of stuff. There was a whole load of stuff that kind of was changing.
But you also worked with Richard Niles, I do believe. That level of arranger, and Richard's a bona fide proper string arranger, that must have had quite an impact on you as a musician.
I mean, the great thing, obviously, is you work with a lot of great people, and you meet a lot of great people that are in these quartets or orchestras, you know, and that, as Graham touched on before, you know, we kind of love that music, and ABC had kind of just done that kind of orchestral kind of vibe. And it's almost kind of Motown, you know, that classic kind of soul kind of stuff. And that was our kind of influence, and thankfully Axel kind of seen that as well, and that was kind of what was happening at the time. You know, and those arrangements are fantastic, you know, that Richard Niles did on the tracks.
I've got to kind
of... Even laterally done on tracks after that as well, you know.
I've got to try...
Yeah, it was so good.
I've got to try and interject here, and just... Neil's been a little bit... he should give himself a bit more praise there. Neil's the guy that brought strings into Wet. And I think everyone understands that it's a major part of our sound now. As I said earlier, Neil likes to play piano and Hammond, but if Neil didn't have all those albums under his arm when we first met him, Neil was pushing us and saying, listen to the Philly sound. You really, these strings are very, very important.
Hey, Tam, can I just come in?
Sure.
You know, the strings as well. I mean, we were, you know, that this was going back to, you know, not just that, but like, you know, the Ziggy Stardust album with the Paul Buckmaster strings, you know what I mean? It was coming for ABC, you know, that was where, you know, we always wanted, I think, even our first demo that we did in City Centre Sound, we got a sax player to come in because we wanted brass and we wanted strings, we wanted huge arrangements, man. That was, you know, that was going to be part of the Wet sound, you know, from day one. You know, even when, you know, the ambition that we had outstripped the songs that we could write, you know what I mean? So, I mean, that was coming from really early days. I was going to go on and say the string arrangements, Richard Niles, yeah, great. I have to come back and say it was actually Richard scored the arrangements, but Axel kind of musically interpreted the arrangements. You know, Angel Eyes, if you listen to it, was scored and scripted and musically notated by Richard Nails, but it was Axel's lines, man.
Ah, okay.
You know, it was Axel's kind of part.
Yeah, it's an...
You can trace the lineage back to the those two great Blow Monkeys records that Axel did, you know, and that was really what hipped us up to working with Michael and Axel. We heard that those Blow Monkeys tracks that were released in the mid-80s, and they sounded fresh, they sounded exciting, and we said, well, who produced them? And that was where we got introduced to Michael and Axel. And they were the guys, you know, as I said to you, Angel Eyes, I was ready to drop that song. You know, and I think I speak for us all here, man. You know, we were all being kind of exhausted by trying to kind of nail it right. When Axel and Michael came in, they threw some fresh air in it, man, and they threw a different kind of side to it that you were like, ah, okay, I get it now, you know. So, I mean, they're pretty pivotal and yeah. Popped In Sold Out. You know, we did do a lot of the production, not a lot of it, but like Wishing was done by Wilf, and then we kind of added to production. Temptation we did in Castle Sound. I'm pretty sure Words of Wisdom was done in Wilf Smarties, you know, and we sort of redid that at Michael with Michael and Axel. So, I mean, they were coming from a different place, you know, and Michael and, you know, they were the New York guys, they were the hip guys, so it kind of gave us a modernity that we never had, you know, yeah. As well as combining the likes of what I said, you know, the strings and the horns and, you know, the big arrangements that we all crave to do.
Graham, it's interesting you're starting to talk, because we're inevitably in these kind of programmes we tend to focus on the big kind of key singles, and we will come back and speak about Sweet Little Mystery, but you started to speak about another couple of the songs in there. And Tommy and I, before we got going this morning, were talking about how you used the word fresh and almost improvised some of the other songs on this album sound. I say yeah. That with great respect, like a lot of them sound like quite early in terms of their songwriting, and quite fresh and quite sort of full of energy. What are your other sort of favourites on the record, Graham?
without having it here, I loved Sweet Little Mystery, because you know, that was the first track that Michael and Axel, you know, they got given the remit, do you want to produce this band? Then go and take one of their tracks and reflect it back to them. And so that was a track that came back pretty early on, where, you know, they'd sort of mocked up a demo version of it and said, look, it could sound like this. And at that moment there, it just sounded like total commercial pop, you know what I mean, just unadulterated pop music, you know. And you know, for me it was like, it was a no-brainer then, because you're like, well, this is going to be played in the radio, and it still gets played today, you know. I think we spoke about this time where yeah. you look at iTunes and you see, you know, the little grey line that tells you how many plays it's had and who's listening to it and how many people are listening to it. And I think Love Is All Around is kind of topped them all, but kind of below it is Angel Eyes and Sweet Little Mystery, yeah. You know. So, you know, although it kind of, it did throw a curveball, because after coming from Wishing I Was Lucky to go somewhere so poppy, it sort of put us in this shiny pop, kind of pop band, bubblegum pop band, you know.
But it does have its roots, doesn't it, Graham? Right in Motown. Bap, bap, bap. You know, that sort of four on the floor.
Yes,
kinda.
It does. The sort of Marvin, not Marvin Gaye, the sort of Smokey Robinson, Tears of a Clown, the sort of ba-da-da-da-da-da-da, that was kind of perfect for it. But I just think, you know, I like that. I'm frantically going through my brain, to see, because I don't have a copy of the album.
Well, I'll tell you, I'll throw one at you, but we'll come back and we'll talk about Sweet Little Mystery in a wee bit more detail, because I think it's a big track we need to talk about. But I mean, East of the River's one, and I know that's one that you still play today, and it's a song that's... But actually, when you listen to the song, it's like there are elements of that are almost like improvised. Would that be right?
Yeah, we had learned certain skills before we got in with the final recording of Popped and Sold Out, as everyone recognises it. We'd had many different attempts at trying to record and re-record and rewrite. One of the things we'd learned doing that is that you have to capture a moment. That's, you don't go in systematically and record songs, because then they sound flat, they really do. You have to catch something. And so East of the River has, it's driven by the keyboard line, by the chord structure, and then everyone else lays right on top of it as hard as they possibly can. And I remember recording, and when you're thinking about recording, I remember the producer coming out every so often saying, we're not getting it, it's not coming together, something's not right. And he said to me, through the headphones, he pressed his little button and said, Tom, we've got a technical difficulty back here with the tapes. Just play through it relaxed as we try and figure out what's going wrong. And off you went. And so the track starts, and I'm playing along and just having fun and messing around. And at the, he could come to the end of it, and he went, right, got it. And I went, what do you mean? He's like, I've tricked you. You know, I've made you feel so relaxed, and you're not thinking about it. Impromptu, on the moment, captured. Next person, on you go. You know, and it's just like, so that has that feel. You said it. We're still playing it live. I don't think there's been a show or a tour where we haven't picked that song back out. It lifts everyone in the room. So, you know, all hail to the arrangement, all hail to the soul history of it. So we're super happy with the song, and it's still our centre point. It's the soul roots. It's a strong, strong statement.
It is. Let's go back. That's great, because I'd love to maybe talk about a wee bit about that in the programme. But let's get back on to Sweet Little Mystery. Graeme, you started talking about it.
Can I come in here?
Of course.
We, you know, as Tommy said, you know, when we recorded that in Amazon, where we caught that kind of indefinable thing that we're trying to kind of converse about, you know, the energy that kind of songs kind of managed to portray. You know, we then went back to Wolf and recorded a version of it, which quite obviously didn't have that kind of essence of the energy and, you know, the indefinable X factor that stands it apart from other songs. Then, you know, of course, we go in with Axel and Michael, and we're sort of wary at this point, you know, of, are we going to do another version that's just going to not be able to capture, you know, it's not going to be as exciting as what we've got before. You know, and that's where Axel kind of worked his magic again, I think, and Michael, you know, by doing that to Tommy and saying, hey, look, Tam, we got a technical, you know, let's do that, or take your clothes off, Tam, get an energy there, you know what I mean? So, I mean, in terms of that, that's the beauty of having someone come in and produce you, you know, they'll bring things out of you and almost make it exciting for you, you know, because that's the other thing I think you forget when you go into record. The recording studio is a fairly sterile environment, you know, and I like the fact that you're saying, you know, these songs sound pretty improvised and pretty energetic and sort of you're making it up as you go along. Obviously, you're trying to do that, but in a sterile environment where it's kind of pretty laid back, you know what I mean? It's a deceptively difficult thing to do, to try and get the energy levels up, you know, and of course, the older you know, lucky we were 21 and 22 when we were doing this, because our energy levels were higher. You know, the older you get, the more your energy levels drop. So, yeah. You know, I'm just thankful that we're sitting here 35 years later and you're talking about, you know, the energy that you hear in the tracks.
Definitely. I think there's, again, just to move it back on to Sweet Little Mystery a wee bit, again, because I think it's relevant. I think there's one track where you do have that kind of visceral energy in the performance, but you've also got this very carefully arranged, and I'm thinking about Graeme Duffin, yeah, that beautiful wee out of phase strat, you know, all these little bits of detail. And there's, I think for me anyway, as you know, coming back to the record so many years later, there's a track where all of these different elements kind of coalesce really beautifully.
Yeah. Wishing I Was Lucky had was earmarked to be the first single, and out it went. The dilemma we had, the album hadn't been recorded yet. The dilemma we had was, how do you follow that up? You know, again, I mentioned earlier, Wishing I Was Lucky had a kind of undefinable sound to it. You know, what genre does it fit to? We hadn't really properly introduced ourselves to anyone. And Axel came back with this demo of Sweet Little Mystery, kept the soul element, in fact, enhanced it, and had ultimate pop. And pop was exploding at the time, you know, within the UK charts. There was a tentative thought process that went, do you know, that is so poppy. But at the same time, we were just at the start of our career, we'd had one tickle of a success, of which I was lucky, and we heard Sweet Little Mystery demo and went, that is an undeniable hit record. There is, you know, it had all the elements that fitted perfectly to the moment of British music, what was happening in the charts. And we honestly, we knew, and we went, right, we're going to go on a ride here. We know we're going to go into the, we're going to go from front cover NME, and in a week's time, we're going to be smash hits. It was obvious that's how poppy we were going to get. We were young, we were naive, we grasped it with both hands, and we went, we're going to become the Monkees for the next 6 months. We are going to be the ultimate British pop band.
That sounds brilliant.
I know, we
be
loved
the Monkees.
And we loved it.
Neil, see when we're on the subject, you know, the instrumentation of that, I started to talk about Graham a wee bit there, and you know, he's, in some ways, he's one of these guys that kind of, a kind of unsung hero, I suppose. And so I know not by you guys, but out there, people maybe don't realise some of the kind of stuff that Graham Duffin's brought to the band over the years.
Who are we talking about? Sorry,
Graham Duffin.
Oh,
I know. I was joking. Yeah. Hi, Graham. Graham's been there since the beginning. You know, the very beginning. I mean, we had auditions in our manager's house for a guitarist because we needed a guitarist, obviously. You know, and he was, I think maybe two or three guys showed up, and he was the guy that was just amazing. And we were like, that's the guy we want. And he's been with us ever since. I mean, no, that was kind of it, really. And he's obviously added a lot. He was a wee bit older than us, so he kind of kept us on the straight and narrow, you know, most of the time, you know.
Did
he? So it was very much.
Well, Graham,
a few years slipped under the cracks the odd time, you know. But he is like an unsung hero, and he's very much part of the band, and his parts and all that are very much part of Wet, you know, his musicianship, and that's. And we've learned a lot from him, you know, because he knows about chords and harmonies, and he's very clever, you know, so that helps us out as well, you know, backing vocals and stuff.
Listen, the thing about, you know, what Neil said about the manager, holding auditions in the manager's back bedroom, man, you know, we were, you know, there was a string of people coming in, and they all looked great, man, do you know what I mean? They all kind of, you know, there was a lot of young guys and, you know, they looked the part, you know, they looked better than us, to be fair, man, you know what I mean? Because they'd sort of been around these guys, you know? And then sort of Grandpa Graham Duffin trapes out his mustard-coloured marina and he's got a big Doctor Who scarf on, a long green trench coat. Like a geography teacher and a goatee and his middle part in hair, man. And and I'm kind of going, do you want a hand with your amp? He's like, ah, well, if you could, that'd be great. And I'm sort of grabbing his amp going, like, ah, this guy's got no chance, man. You know what I mean? and you know, I'm kind of, you know, at that point, I'm getting, you know, not depressed, but you're getting a bit like, are we going to, you know, is there such a thing as a wet guitarist, you know? Can we find this elusive guy, you know? And I'm looking at him and going, well, he's definitely not it. He comes in and we sort of go through the motions of, you know, running a couple of numbers with him. And all he had to do was, you know, his first three notes. And you do know instantly. It's a bit like when you write a song and you sort of, you know, you come across a chord progression and you kind of go, yeah, man, we've got lots of mileage here, man. We can take this somewhere. With Graham Duffin, it was exactly the same. The minute he played, you were like, oh, my God, man, this is, you know, not only how I hear it, but this is the way it should be.
Graham, what are the specific qualities of that, though? Because I totally hear what you're saying. It fits. He brings his experience. But what are the specific elements of the way that he played that added?
Well, I think with Graham, you know, I mean, he's kind of, you know, and I don't mean to sound disingenuous here, but he can play like Dave Gilmour. He can play like Mark Knopfler. He can do anything you want. You know, if you say, oh, he's a wee bit of Knopfler, man, you know, he's away and he can do it and he knows it all. And he's knowledge of music in terms of, you know, what people are doing guitar-wise, you know. I've never heard a guitarist that can do what he does in so many different kind of genres. So in terms of that, I think is the specific is purely down to the musicianship, you know, and what he brings to that. Because, you know, I was always like, well, you know, if we need a guitarist, we can always bring guys in. And we've done that from time to time. We brought Robbie McIntosh in from the Pretenders at some point. You know, we brought him in to play some guitar, you know, who's one of the best guitarists in the world, without a doubt. You know, but I think with Graham, he's much more, you know, it's much more a team player. With a guy like Robbie, you're bringing him in to do specific kind of things, you know what I mean? Whereas with Graham, as Neil kind of sort of alluded to, you know, his musicality, you know, he's known for kind of working out harmonies and the way music is put together. I think, if anything, we are a melodic bunch of people, do you know what I mean? So in terms of what you're doing, it's a complex thing melodically. And if, you know, if you get that wrong, it can go horribly wrong quite quickly, man, you know what I mean? But so you need someone in there that's going to be able to interpret the ideas properly and what we're trying to do, yeah, and make it sound. I think that's what, you know, when you come to break down, you know, when I'm looking at wet songs, and that's the problem, I never listen to them in a linear sense the way other people enjoy them. I'm forever in there like that. Oh, that could be a wee bit, but we could do this. And so you never listen to it the way it should be listened to. You know, so in terms of that, I think when you're writing a song, all you're trying to do is make it sound as natural and as simple as possible. Now, we all know music is not simple. You know, music is a complex thing, no matter if you're playing one chord or not. There's so many differentials in there. And that's where Graham Duffin specifics come in and sort things out. You
beautiful,
know?
Beautiful, beautiful. Right, listen, we've got under 10 minutes left, and I want to try and sort of wrap, and bear in mind, we're not going to be able to use all of this. I just want to wrap up with two or three kind of things.
I remember the moment you left.
So, Tommy, give us a quick, because I did ask that question, give us a quick resume of what you were talking there, right, and then I'll come on to the next question.
All right, now, Popped In Sold Out as an album was a phenomena. You know, it really did sell bucket loads. There's many songs on there. It spawned 4 top 10 singles. Temptations is a moment. We recorded that totally live. That was probably the song that gave Wet Wet confidence to be self-producing from the moment on after Popped In Sold Out. We realised that certain styles of songs where it's just the band playing, we have that down pat. We know how to go into a room, set up and play. Temptation is pure feel, start to finish. That is 1, 2, 3, 4. No click tracks, no technology. That is the true sound of Wet to Wet, Temptation. And the passion in that, you know, again, it screams out of the speakers. So there's that song.
Beautiful, beautiful. Yeah.
But I go back to the real beginnings of Popped In Sold Out. There's one song that stands out, and it's The Moment You Left Me. It comes from a kind of Stax place, so it does. I remember NME, the magazine, the music magazine, giving away a cassette, and it was the Stax tour of the UK. And even though I knew soul music, this was a reintroduction. Moment You Left Me is a Stax style song. And we jumped on top of that as soon as those chords came out and Marty's voice soaring over the top, and managed to get on TV. We were on the Tube 2 years before releasing Popped In Sold Out with The Moment You Left Me. You should go back and check it out. Real soul, real depth.
And I think that's good though, Toby, because I think that is part of the thing, because I think what people forget as well is that there was a certain legend around about Wet Wet Wet, specifically in Glasgow, before you could, you know, this was these are the Great White Hopes kind of thing. And I think a lot of that kind of stuff fed into it. And it leads on to my question, because I think when the record itself came out, There was a kind of corporate sheen about that, and even in terms of the way that the cover was done and all that,
yeah,
that was quite surprising, I think, to a lot of people. But it did sort of perfectly capture the music, didn't it?
Yeah, there was a change on musically within the UK. A wave was coming along. We were considered very indie, very NME, Melody Maker front cover, the young soul saviours, if you like, of British pop music. And we embraced that, but we took all these other elements, the real, as you say, shine production, and we put it all together. And there's a huge marketing tool behind it as well, which is the record companies who get the cover together and do all the kind of press and the angles to it. Our job is purely to turn up and play the songs and look good and entertain. When you put that with the huge machine, the invention of the CD, the awash with money and the way it could be sold, we got on that wave, you know, and we sailed it right the way through, popped in, sold out. And it, so the journey from us, from school right the way through until winning our Brit Award, you know, as being Britain's best new band sort of thing, it was an incredible, incredible journey. So many elements, so many tears, so much pain, so many great, great moments.
And I get, as you say, you went on and made many other successful albums and big hit singles and all that. But there is a kind of sense, I think, that there's such a concentration of energy and popped in, sold out in terms of the writing and the way that the music came together. When you look back at it now, it's a cliche question, but let's ask it anyway. Graham, when you look back on that record just now, how do you feel popped in, sold out has stood up?
I think it's a difficult question because obviously as a musician, as a songwriter, you're always looking forward, you know, very rare. The only time you're looking back is when you're doing a tour, you're doing a gig, and you're obviously playing these songs. And sometimes I listen to it and I think, you know, we're stuck in the constraints of 1987's recording technology. You know, there's certain things that I hear, like when I hear the intro to Sweet Little Mystery, I hear the Lexicon reverb on it. Do you know what I mean? That kind of ties it, you know, unashamedly to the 80s. Do you know what I mean? Like, as soon as you hear the keyboard, as soon as you hear the reverb on the guitar, it takes you back instantly, you know, and sort of time stamps it in a sense. I think that's the bit that, you know, as I said to you, I don't listen to it the way that everybody and the way that we should be listening to music because I am a musician and because I do know how studios work. So in terms of that, it's a blessing and it's a curse because, you know, as I say, you never listen to music, you know, unless you go back to somebody like Bob Dylan or Neil Young, you know, where you're listening to a singer-songwriter with an acoustic guitar, you know, you're always kind of looking at the production, looking at what they've recorded, you know. So, I mean, I'm no different when I go back to Popped In, Sold Out. I know I'm not really answering this question right. I think it's weathered well, you know. I think the fact that we still play, you know, if you look at the set, pretty much that's probably, that and Picture This, it's where the nucleus of the songs and the set come from, you know. So in terms of that, I think the songwriting was strong. I think that's testimony to, you know, the old cliched argument of, you know, a band's got 10 years to write the first album and then they've got like 18 months to write their second album. You know, I hear today there's a lot of bands and a lot of singer-songwriters, they've got 100 songs. We had 12 songs, man, you know, and we worked hard on them and made them work. And, you know, that's kind of... There was no big mystery there. We sat with these 12 songs and made them the best that they could be. And I think that's probably one of the reasons that we still play the majority of them today.
Quick wrap up from Neil and then we'll come to Tommy. Anything to add to that, Neil?
I just want to say, I mean, like Graham, it's not something that I listen to that often, you know, the first album. But yeah, I think a lot of the songs stand up, you know. The singles in particular, and that's the ones that we play today. I mean, I think it's just, it was a great album to introduce the public, obviously, to the band, you know, a great starting point, and, you know, on we go, you know.
Yeah, Tommy.
Wet or Wet have always had huge ambitions and very wide horizons when it came to music. Popped In, Sold Out encapsulates the whole 5-year run-up to it. It is not one genre of music, even though we always say, and still do say, we're a soul band. That's the feeling, that's the passion we put into it. But popped in Sold Out has rock, R&B, dance, soul through and through, pop, undoubtedly a very wide vista. And that just kicked open the doors for us to go, where do we go next? We can do nothing apart from go up from here.
A beautiful way to close it.
Do you know, it's strange to look back over 30 years and try to piece together the memories, but it's been a nice experience sitting here, reliving some of those moments and some of those memories, and hearing the other guys in the band's perspective on it, you know, because we've shared this journey for 30 years, and that was the beginnings of it.
More power to you guys.
BBC Radio Scotland.
Yeah, we got there in the end. And after some careful editing, I hope you'll agree that the polished episode is another cracker. Popped in, Sold Out, an undoubted classic Scottish album. Thanks again, Tommy, Neil and Graham. And a special thanks to producer Elizabeth Clark for coping with the technical challenges that came her way. As ever, we'd love to hear what you're making of these bonus episodes, these uncut, extended interviews, and of course the main event too, the half-hour programmes. You'll find us on BBC Radio Scotland's social media feeds, and we're also enjoying reading your reviews on the Apple Podcast app. Please keep them coming. Next week, it's the final episode in the run, and I'm going to be chatting to Alan Rankin about the Associates album, Sulk. We had a really, really great chat, so don't miss that one. I'm Davey Scott. Thanks for listening.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.